I am Gaius, John Batchelor. This is the Friends of History Debating Society. Germanicus is traveling. He's in Pict country in Edinburgh. And we're observing the magical thinking in Kiev. Now we go to the magical thinking in Moscow, Kremlin. Vladimir Putin, the president who is running for re-election within months, provided an interview with a celebrity journalist named Carlson, who is late of Fox News, I believe. And the interview gave us no new information about the confrontation with NATO. But it did give us information about how Putin's been reading history. Germanicus, it's good that Putin has a historical background, and it's good that he's applying himself to it, but I'm puzzled about how he means to live. I mean, he's like he's thinking he owes something to Alexander Nevsky. He's got some vision of Russia that's going to confront the Europeans and freeze them in place so that they, what, cooperate with Russia? He doesn't want to conquer it. He wants to be respected by it. How did you hear him?
Well, at the extreme risk of skirting any appearance of empathy for the tyrant himself, I think looking at his approach to his, you know, conveying his side or Russia's side of a situation in which the West has been obdurately unwilling to even entertain where Russia is coming from, in a situation like that, where he wants to explain, and yet he has been so totally and thoroughly rejected for so long, what a person will do in that situation, quite naturally, is want to try and go back to the beginning and explain every little detail so that, you know, in some perhaps desperate attempt to say, look, there's something going on here. I want to explain this. And yet there's no way that he could ever explain the Russian point of view here. And it is really quite interesting because there is a lot to explain. There is a lot going on in Russia going back not just to Catherine the Great, but Peter the Great, even back to, you know, the so-called Ivan the Terrible. You know, there's been an effort on the part of Russia all these centuries to insinuate itself into Europe, and it has never quite succeeded. It's always been rebuffed. And so the attempt to go back and explain the treaties with the Ottoman Empire and all the rest is a bridge too far, because the West, at least in terms of Western elites, has decided that Russia is the new changeling enemy. It's the new evil specter in the world, and not simply as a kind of Manichaean demiurge, but also as a very convenient fixture through which the U.S. can orchestrate its continuing dominance of NATO and also create a believable gameplay for checkmating China in the Far East over Taiwan, et cetera, et cetera. And as a result, there's no way that Russia's ever going to get a fair hearing. And yet here he is, it's almost kind of sad, trying to explain it yet again. No one's going to listen to him. And the result is that only deeds will gain what Russia seeks. And yet, you know, you can see in the things that Putin offered, and you can decide whether or not that's a real offer or not. He held out the prospect of a negotiation. Russia doesn't want the war. Its terms are not onerous. It's not going to invade other NATO countries. It wants, by implication at least, he didn't say this explicitly, but he did basically imply a Ukraine, whatever it looks like, that would be its own place as long as it's not a part of NATO. I mean, all the things that were essentially part of the offer, quote unquote, that was made before the special military operation began, all that was there and restated. But again, no one wants to address that. And it's going to have to be addressed, but it's going to be addressed by deeds. And I think what Putin was doing in that context was to begin to, how should we put it, begin to frame what the terms of entry would be for the West in terms of a succeeding negotiation. At some point, there will be a negotiation. There'll have to be things that are negotiated, even if Ukraine is utterly defeated. But there will be a period where the West will have to come to terms with the outcome of events on the battlefield. And so he was kind of laying that out. And I think that was probably the most useful and important part of the interview, is that he was basically saying, this isn't an all or nothing thing. And, you know, Russia certainly isn't the Stalinist or czarist state seeking to expand deep into Poland, et cetera, et cetera, and the Baltics or Finland. It instead is willing to quite happily come to terms amicably with NATO and to resolve everything. And yet it's going to be ignored until it can't be ignored. And so that in many ways, I guess I see the interview as a kind of ritual and symbolic occasion, using the venue of an interview with an American journalist as a way to convey the framing of the discussions that are to come, so that he's at least saying this is the kind of structure that will take going in. It won't be our final offer, obviously, but it begins to frame the basis for negotiation. And that's important because the West has never found a way to do that itself. In other words, NATO and the United States have never offered a framework for negotiations other than complete Russian submission to Ukrainian maximalist demands. So what Putin is doing is taking the initiative here, and he's creating the framing of what will be the initial conversations that lead to a negotiation.
I took time to watch a 1995 movie, Crimson Tide. Do you recall it, Germanicus?
I do indeed. Gene Hackman?
Gene Hackman, Denzel Washington, about yes. a boomer that is scrambled to respond to a Russian coup, where a
right.
man named Radchenko is taking over a nuclear weapons base in the far Siberian near Vladivostok, is the best I can figure. And the Russian regular army is launched to stop him because he has the missiles and the silos but he doesn't have the code. So the drama is, can they get there in time? Can the Russians get there in time and rescue the world from this madman named Radchenko? The reason I'm mentioning is because it occurred to me, that, which is why I looked at it, it's, you know, it doesn't have cell phones. You understand. It's 1995.
Yeah.
But still, we're looking at a time where we conceived Russia as dangerous with nuclear weapons and right. prey to coups, takeovers, madmen. It's the Putin script, Michael. It's Hollywood anticipating Putin. Or the other way to put it is, we only see the Hollywood version. That's all we can see.
Yeah.
That
I would take the latter, because in many ways, Crimson Tide was not simply a prefiguration. It was the first instantiation, if you will, of the narrative that we have now about Putin and about Russia. In other words, in Crimson Tide, you have the idea that Russia is not truly stable and not truly unified and it's got all of these fissures and issues and could come apart at any moment. And of course, that is an essential and even integral part of the narrative today, certainly on the part of neocons who are promising that if we degraded Russia sicking Ukraine on it, that Russia might overthrow Putin and come apart. So in many ways, a Hollywood narrative from 1995 is still the point of departure for how Americans imagine Russia. And it has no point of tangency with actual reality in Russia.
Yes, and the payoff was that the Alabama, that was the boomer, was going to launch nuclear weapons against Russia. That was the payoff. We were going to attack. And the drama was to keep Gene Hackman from pushing the button. That was the drama. It wasn't their side. It turns out their side collapsed.
Yeah.
It was our side.
In this sense, the movie was a prefiguration in that there are competing factions, you know, in the U.S. There's Denzel Washington, who is slightly more restrained. Let's not escalate in Ukraine. Let's keep a lid on here. And then there are the neocons, who are more like Gene Hackman. Oh, let's have a no-fly zone in Western Ukraine. Oh, let's send long-range rockets to Ukraine so they can attack deep into Russia, that sort of thing. And this is, in a metaphorical way, exactly what's happened in the war.
Or we'll nuke them. And I would have laughed at that, except for that announcement that we're forward-basing B-61 gravity bombs at an RAF base in the UK. And so,
the sad conclusion, or at least the sad sensation, is that the U.S. is the more unstable element here, not the Russians. I mean, the U.S. is thinking in highly aggressive terms, no matter how you dress it up and try and paint Russia as the manic rabid dog attacking the West. The truth is all of the aggressive movement in this war, in terms of escalation and ultimately a kind of a confrontation that would lead to World War III, is coming from the U.S.
Speaking at a rally in Conway, South Carolina, the candidate Trump recounted a story he had told before about an unidentified NATO leader who confronted him over his threat not to defend members who failed to meet their transatlantic alliance's defense spending targets. But this time, Mr. Trump went further, saying he had told the member that he would, in fact, encourage Russia to do as it
you
wishes.
Probably know, 2 days ago, the Biden...
In that case, you didn't pay? You're delinquent, Mr. Trump recounted, saying, no, I would not protect you. In fact, I would encourage them to do whatever the heck they want. You got to pay. You got to pay your bills. Germanicus, that starts like a Hollywood movie. They started Crimson Tide on a French aircraft carrier with a CNN announcer saying Russia's gone crazy. What does that sound like? In Conway, South Carolina, Trump's saying, when I'm president, I'm going to turn Germany over to be beaten up by Putin. It's nutty.
Well, I mean, the base or the ferociously ardent supporters of Mr. Trump eat that stuff.
Well,
up.
How does the Moscow audience hear it?
I think they're laughing along with the people, you know, the Trumpistas, who are also laughing, because you have to understand that entire spiel, that entire little performance, has nothing to do with NATO. It's all about reinforcing his promise to his base that he will overthrow the pieties and the kind of false promises and crazy illusion of the ruling class.
So he's Rutchenko.
Who got us into this problem.
He's Rutchenko,
he's basically
Michael.
Making fun of the war.
Rutchenko, and the Crimson Tide is flipped. It'll be the Russian submarine out there in the Atlantic who's not sure that we've not fallen into the hands of a radical who's going to launch nuclear weapons.
Well, however you want to look at it, the fact is that there has been much more weirdness and wackiness in general, whether it's from red or blue and from whatever mouth and whatever, you know, candidate or president. The wackiness is much greater in the West generally throughout this war than on the Russian side. And Russia has been very, and here I'm thinking especially of Mr. Putin. He's been extremely restrained in terms of.
There was a shot early in the movie when the CNN commentator mm-hmm. is telling us the plot. You know, we only have X number of hours. Rutchenko is rising. There's a shot of Bill Clinton as president. Wow. Yeah. Just wow. Just wow.
I know. Yeah. Well, it, Hollywood is not good at accessing or getting a handle on actual reality. But Hollywood is real good at taking the pulse of the zeitgeist in the U.S., and that's what you see in the movie. And the fact is, the U.S. is burdened now in this war by perpetuating a false narrative of Russia and using it as an existential foundation for our foreign and national security policy to our detriment, in the sense that we've gone off and done something over the last 10 years, and it's gone south. We're on the verge of a terrible foreign policy calamity.
Let's go to Rome, Germanicus. Germanicus is Michael Vlahos. I'm Gaius John Bachelor. It's Londinium. It's 90 AD. And Germanicus and I are going to have some fun with the Roman history of the first century. We're going to talk about Cicero and a woman named Claudia Metellae, the Medea of the Palatine. This is Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Bachelor.